Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
This is Irish Illustrated Insider, Tim Priester, Tim O'Malley, Pete Sampson, talking Notre Dame football here on Monday, April 19th. And, of course, remembering our dear friend and associate in the business, Lou Somogyi. I go way back with Lou. For those that haven't heard, and I think everybody in the sporting world, the Notre Dame football world, heard about his unfortunate passing on Saturday. And we, of course, will reflect on the greatness and the uniqueness of Mr. Lou Somogyi. But starting with Notre Dame football today, 10 practices in the book as of Saturday, the two-thirds mark. And surprise, surprise, we're still talking offensive line because it was a heavy topic of conversation with Brian Kelly on Saturday following practice.
Yeah, there's a lot there. I mean, I think that it was like follow-up after follow-up after follow-up. Like, I basically was at the end and had to ask him to repeat something he already said just because I was like, are you sure? Like, you're saying Jared Patterson could play guard? Could you say that one more time so I'm not misinterpreting it? I think that they have probably more questions today than they had when they started because Fisher and Spindler have impressed so much. But Brian Kelly also said, I thought pretty clearly, like, all right, let's get to the answer phase of spring practice. We got to get something done in the last five where we can't go into summer where we are today.
I wonder if they can do that because I thought Josh Lugg made a great point when he said, and this is obviously coming from his position coach, the spring is not about winning the starting job or cementing all our starting jobs. It's about getting everybody out there and getting as many reps as possible. As long as the coaches think to themselves, all right, we have two candidates here, one, and two candidates here, or something like that. I feel like that's solidified. And then you can figure it out in the summer in camp. Because, like, as Chip Long mentioned, like, Hainsey made me play him. He wasn't going to play at the end of the spring. There's always a guy you could have a great summer and think that there's nothing wrong with having a great summer and ascending into a new position.
Yeah, I think I agree more with you, Tim, than I do, Pete, in that, I mean, I do think that there are more answers because whereas John Dirksen was getting first team reps at right guard when practice started, right, Tim? And I think that's kind of what you're saying. I mean,
yeah.
I think that they're moving past that notion a bit. Andrew Christofik has played a couple different positions, center. I don't really think that he's in a position to compete for the starting job. And Michael Carmody's just a redshirt freshman. So I hear what you're saying. Because there's still so many specifics to still be determined about the offensive line, but clearly, and again, we want to clarify that, you know, Brian Kelly didn't say that Fisher and Spindler are going to start or Fisher has won a starting job. Fisher still has to compete with Baker at left tackle and Dylan Gibbons has had a good spring and that's still, a challenge for Spindler. But what I think has happened is, okay, 10 practices into this, we know that Fisher and Spindler are players and we can feel comfortable moving forward, giving them the reps that they need with the first and second team because we think that they can be on the field this fall.
Yeah, I guess maybe it could be a wash in terms of questions versus answers. If you're moving Spindler into like, ooh, this we could start this guy, but then you're moving like a Dirksen out. Which maybe that's kind of what you're getting at there. It's like you still have maybe seven candidates for five jobs, but it's a different seven today than
right,
it was on March 1st.
Right, and I think in the first week or two, they were a little bit more open-minded or trying to be a little bit more open-minded about how many actual starting candidates there were. I think that part has been dwindled down the last few weeks. So we've got more questions than we know what to deal with on offensive line in the
That's
second
true.
Segment.
Yeah. Okay.
I've tried to insert some different topics.
I was about to insert, but you're right. I just looked down. I'm not doing that anymore. Okay.
Yeah, so we'll have more on that in the second segment. But it was interesting again to hear defensive players once again saying that this is just a much easier defense to play. And I don't know that we ever felt like Clark Lee's defense was difficult to play because they played well. It wasn't like they were blowing assignments. It wasn't the Brian Van Gorder era. I mean, they knew what they needed to do. They were in place and they made plays. But from a technical standpoint, from a player's perspective, they feel like, okay, they know what they're doing pre-snap. We get lined up. That MTA said there's no checks. You just go. And when you're a football player, you know, an aggressive football player especially, I think that's exactly what you want to hear.
I remember, I think it was after the first group of press conferences when we talked to Bo Bauer and Paul Mawala about this, and I tweeted something about it. In a group of five, coach in the MAC tweeted back at me or sent me a DM like, well, that's exactly what you would expect because it's one practice or 10 practices in opposed to 3 years. Like if you were taking an academic class, right? Like if you skipped ahead to your junior year, that would be a lot more complicated than what you were learning your freshman year. Will that parallel hold in the season? I still think this will be a much simpler defense, but it may be, I guess my point is more like it may be even more simple now than it will be in the fall, which it could still be more simple than what Clark Lee ran. But I think right now it's probably a basic of the basic for Marcus Freeman.
I would kind of took it twofold. I thought like this defense could be more fun and free. Doesn't mean that Clark's was complicated as much as it was very structured and that you are doing this on this play and you have only this other read to do. Do not deviate from that. Otherwise, you're going to mess up our structure. Like that's how I kind of look at Clark Lee's was kind of like, I think maybe it's part of the reason Shane Simon played so much. Honestly, what Shane Simon would do, what Clark Lee said to do. And I think that helped him play more snaps over Leofile and some guys. But the second part of it is, and I want to jump ahead and quote our dear friend Lou Somogyi, every time there's a change, something is faster, something is more player-friendly, and something is more aggressive, because no one's ever said, this defense is so much more complicated and head-scratching than the last one. It just doesn't get announced that way.
Well,
so, whatever happens there.
I promise you, as many times as you heard Lou say that, I heard it 10,000 times more. I hear what you're saying. And Pete, I definitely understand what you're saying that, you know, come game time when you're scheming against an opponent, it's going to get a little bit more difficult. By the same token, it's our understanding at Irish Illustrated that the bulk of what they want to do has been installed this spring and that the defense, mainly the upperclassmen, the guys that they know are going to play all the time, have adapted to it. So, you know, I don't know. I think this is something that will constantly evolve. Maybe we'll see a little bit more on Blue Gold game day. We definitely will see a lot more on that day. And then as we go into the fall, certainly when you're scheming for opponents, you have to adapt and adjust to that. But it's still players saying, you know, I mean, Kurt Heinisch is talking about he gets more one-on-ones with centers, and when he goes one-on-one with centers, he usually wins.
He was a fun interview.
Really was, because he just kind of – he stated some things really confidently in a very matter-of-fact way, and he should feel that way because he is – I mean, I think I'm seeing I don't want to say dominant, but I'm seeing a more impressive nose tackle in these one-on-one situations. So, you know, that's all going to become a little bit more clear to us as we move forward. And now, as with regard to Brian Kelly's comments about the wide receivers, he was talking about the veterans are the ones that have to lead this. And he's saying, and as he's saying those words, you know, you guys do the same thing. You know how readers and fans are going to react to that. I'm trying to look at it from a coach's perspective, and of course you want the upperclassmen to win the job. They're 3 years stronger than everybody. They're 3 years deeper into the playbook, and you know they've adapted to the classroom work that they've just been around. You want your veteran players to win the jobs. I think the difference here is those guys are playing really quality football from what we can see on film.
Well, man, I have a hard time with this because like Braden Lindsay, Joe Wilkins, Lawrence Keyes had 19 catches for 177 yards and 2 touchdowns last year. Against Clemson, Clemson and Alabama, they had 1 catch for 20 yards. I feel like it should not take a receiver 4 years to grow into the system and get strong enough to play. I don't know. I don't know what to make of the receiver position. I guess I was hoping that, you know, Jordan Johnson, Xavier Watts would be more like in the group with, like, Brian Kelly would single out 5 guys and say Lindsay, Wilkins, Keyes, Johnson, Watts, like the sophomores would be to the point where like, okay, they've turned our heads. These are guys we can play, but it seems like they're going to go with the 4 senior receivers who have either been incredibly injury prone. No, they all have had their injury issues. And then Avery Davis, which is, I don't know. I thought that there would be more of a spring move from Johnson and or Watts.
We also might be taking him too much at his word on that particular Saturday, kind of like everybody ran with Zeke Correll. Zeke Correll thing. I mean, maybe he wants – Joe Wilkins has shown up on all the videos. Maybe he wants to challenge Joe Wilkins to keep showing up. Maybe he wants to challenge Braden Lindsay. Maybe he wants to challenge Braden Lindsay to, hey, you had 2 good practices, and I'm making up something right here. And then you sat out and barely did anything in another practice. Maybe he doesn't want that. You know,
I mean, remember when they benched Chase Claypool during spring ball? Like, he ran with the 2s going into his junior year and then turned into a second-round pick, like,
well, yeah, 12 months but that later? That could have been because he freaked out in the locker room before practice. I mean, there are multiple reasons why Claypool – look, I'm not saying – and I had to clarify this on Twitter because imagine I was – misinterpreted on Twitter. I'm not saying that freshman receivers shouldn't play. I'm absolutely not saying that. I'm just saying the older guys, and you're right, they should develop sooner. And I mean, so maybe they need to do things on the practice field to develop them sooner. And that could mean a change in coaching personnel. I don't know, but I'm not saying freshmen can't play and shouldn't play. But when you have 5 senior or redshirt seniors that are practicing. I mean, look at Joe Wilkins. You can't say that that's not an improved version of Joe Wilkins. Braden Lindsay, you know, the fact that Braden Lindsay and Lawrence Keyes are answering the bell every time they practice is a huge step forward. They're making plays. Are they giving us plays? Like, who's determining what plays we get to see? You know what I'm saying? I mean, is it somebody that's doing the video, or is it somebody actually within the football department saying, emphasize what Joe Wilkins just did there, emphasize what Lawrence Keyes. I find that really hard to believe that a staff would do that.
I think there is some of that. Okay. Maybe not in practice 10, but like at least in the beginning, right?
Yeah.
Did you, Tim, didn't you get a tweet from someone that said, who is doing these ND highlights? Because I believe it must be Joe Wilkins' parents or something like that. Yeah. He is all over it. I just feel like Wilkins would be, this would be a great story for Joe Wilkins. He comes in the season, is so much improved, and he is a great complementary piece to the wide receivers when Kevin Austin and Braden Lindsay and Jordan Johnson break out. That's kind of the best case, right?
Right. And at the end of the day, I don't care which receivers excel. I absolutely do not care.
You want a senior to be a complementary piece at least, though, because he probably won't choke down in Florida State and stuff like that. I mean, he played 12 games last year. You know, he got out there.
And that's my whole point of, you know, I say 3 years stronger. It's 3 years more of being on the sideline for big games, whether you're playing or not. It's still preparing to play a football game. And this game probably more than any requires a lot of experience because it is physical and it's the magnitude of everything that's happening is just incredibly pressure packed, more so than, well, you know, basketball is kind of comparable, more so than me covering Notre Dame baseball.
I mean, I'm not saying, I'm just saying, but like we just spent a bunch of time talking about Blake Fisher and Rocco Spindler.
Right. Yeah. You know,
yeah.
And like that's a position where like physical strength in a college weight room would matter a lot more than a receiver, right?
And don't they look like they're capable of playing now? Just like Joe Wilkins. Yeah. I think Joe Wilkins looks like.
No, I mean, I think it's an uncomfortable conversation that we're probably not ready to have yet, but like Jordan Johnson probably is not beating out Joe Wilkins. If that says more about Jordan Johnson than Joe Wilkins, then so be it. Like somebody has to be out there.
Yeah. Hey, let's wrap up segment one here with, you know, I want to be serious about Lou now and what a incredible human being. I hate to talk in past tense about what an incredible human being he is, was. I mean, the two words that come to mind most for me are humble. His level of humility is beyond anything that I've ever known. And the selflessness to people that he worked with, to people that he competed against, to every human being that I've ever known that knew him, it was just off the chart.
I mean, he was great, kind, probably the kindest person that I have ever met in this industry and perhaps outside this industry. There's a lot of cynicism and sarcasm in journalism, probably a lot of cynicism more than sarcasm, but like Lou didn't have any of that. You know, he was funny and self-deprecating. I guess he could be sarcastic about himself.
Yeah, but I was like, going to say there was some of that.
But like such a kind-hearted person and just like a reminder that you can do this job and be a nice person, which I think is something that, you know, we struggle with at times and think about a lot. And I mean, Lou was just, he was a real rarity in this industry. And it was, it was an honor to work with him for a few years at Blue and Gold and know him. I remember my son was born in May of 2013. And in August, I remember him flagging me down as I was driving home from the Goog, from a press conference. And he's like, he had like a hand knit blanket for him. And it just like, who the hell does that? Like one person, Lou Somogyi. He was just like an incredibly, incredibly thoughtful person. So yeah, yes, it was really heartbreaking to hear that on Sunday.
Yeah. It was terrible news. Everything you guys say, I can't even, don't really need to add to it, but his genuineness is the word I always use. He's so genuine in how he treated other people and other centered, as Pete, that is part of your example. He would help anybody with anything. And I think we all have to take that into consideration when anybody asks us for a favor, because I just wrote about this today. One of my last texts from Lou is, I had a question I couldn't answer. It was about women's basketball from Matt Cashore. He had to do something for a photo. I was like, well, let me ask Lou. And Lou responds right away. And I responded quickly because of Lou to Cashore, you know, because Lou got back right away. I didn't know the answer. And Cashore's apt response was, yeah, I guess I probably should have asked him first, right? I was like, yes, you should have. Just go right ahead and ask. Go to the source next time on these things. But, I mean, Lou contacted me when my mom, my dad, and my older brother, who he knew, passed away. He's that type of person. He takes time for others. Yeah. And I should add, because it'll never be another good place to add this in the history of our podcast, but Lou hired me at Blue and Gold to be a writer for their website, which I did for a little less than a year, just on the website blogging. I covered football from the blogger's point of view, where I wasn't at the games, and basketball at the games. I started going for Blue and Gold. And then when we all the part-timers got furloughed at Blue and Gold, Lou recommended me for the job I have now, starting at Scout, which has been bought out by Irish Illustrated and 24/7 all that. But yeah, that was Lou recommending me for that job.
Last thing here in this segment, and I'm not sure everybody realizes this, that, you know, Lou's parents were direct descendants from Hungary. So, and I'm Hungarian. And so I think we had a lot in common and working together many times late at night and everything, you know, that you had to go through back in a time when technologically publishing a newspaper was a lot more difficult than it is now. You know, and Lou's first language was Hungarian. It wasn't English. And I don't think that necessarily surprises a whole lot of people. But Lou it was a very uneasy fit in this world. He didn't fit in this world quite like everybody else does. And I say that in a good way, because he was a saint amongst a bunch of sinners, and I include myself in that group. So I hope he continues to look down upon us and upon me, because I think I'm going to need a little bit of help. Segment two coming up.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Burning up the board. Segment 2 of Irish Illustrated Insider. We start with a question from Wash ND. Before the spring, what odds would you have given me on the starting O-line versus Florida State, consisting of Blake Fisher and Josh Lugg at tackle, Jared Patterson at guard, Zeke Correll at center? And what odds would you give me now for that?
Go with none and now some. Right? Yeah. I mean, it was a no. I would not have allowed odds for that.
Because I would have said Patterson's a tackle and Fisher's a guard.
Right.
And I still think that Fisher will play guard professionally and maybe at some point in Notre Dame, but whatever.
You're kicking that can down the road.
He has played so with so much balance, and I don't know where I said this, Tim, did I say it on Instant Analysis? There's nothing I hate more watching an offensive lineman when he's on the ground, and Blake Fisher isn't on the ground. He's on his feet, because when you're on your feet, you can block much better than when you're on the ground.
That's a valid point.
I still don't think it ends up what that alignment says.
No, but it exists now.
It exists now. Yeah. There's a patent for it, I guess, so to speak, with Brian Kelly. But this is going to continue to evolve, but I think it's become a good thing, because, I mean, who in the world expects, outside of fans that think something good's always going to happen, that two early entry freshman offensive linemen are going to perform well enough that you can, at the very least, they're in the top seven, and you can legitimately consider them for a starting spot.
Yeah, because it's not 2007, right?
No.
There's some players.
No.
I mean,
it's like they have good players.
Quentin Nelson didn't play as a freshman.
They expect to be good. Yeah. That's Notre Dame expects to be good. This isn't some massive rebuilding year. So it's I'm stunned by this whole thing. I didn't think this was really even a long shot possibility that Fisher and Spindler could start as true freshmen.
ND Band 94. Do you think the ND defense is way ahead of the offense, or do you think it's closer and just that it takes time for an offense to get going and we still need Kevin Austin and Patterson in before the offense can really gel?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's some combination of both. I think anytime, look, regardless of how good freshman offensive linemen look, we don't know about chemistry. And if you watch practice 10 on Saturday, that was a defense. What we saw was definitely defensive dominated. Defensive front seven dominated the clips that we saw on Saturday. So I think it's a combination of both. The fact that Marcus Freeman takes a more aggressive approach also contributes to it. So you take a more aggressive approach with an offensive line that has no chemistry, and you're going to get results like that.
I mean, there's no question about who's starting on the defensive line, and we couldn't, other than Zeke Correll, we can't tell you one starter on the offensive line. So, I mean, it makes sense that the defensive line would be way ahead of that version of an offensive line.
I think they're going to be way ahead in August and early September, though, too. I think the defense of front seven is the strength of the team, and they're going to have a good year up there.
I totally agree.
Yeah, they're going to be better than the offense. Hey, Nick Saban said it, offense wins championships. Well, Notre Dame's going to have to win about 12 of its 12 games with defense.
Imagine if Owusu-Koramoah had been in some kind of position to return for his last year of eligibility. That would have been ridiculous. But
stop the practice.
Yeah, there's nobody left.
So guys that are moving. I mean, Kaiser looks like he's the front runner in an outside linebacker position. He's a smart player. He knows where to be. He makes plays instinctually / because he understands the game. I think it's pretty incredible that Kurt Heinisch is going to end up playing 60 some games for Notre Dame, which of course is pandemic induced. But it's a really veteran defensive line. MTA is playing really, really well on several accounts now. So yeah, they're going to be ahead, and you're right, Tim. They will be ahead in the fall, absolutely. I'm going to put two questions together. First one from Terry Benedict: when was the last time two freshman offensive linemen starred on the same line for Notre Dame? And then Irish, I was tailgating. Would it be good or bad? Would it be a good or bad indication for the 2021 season if there were two freshmen starting on the offensive line?
I mean, it would be a bad indication, I think, of what happened prior, because it would mean probably Quinn Carroll never recovered or is misevaluated, that all the progress we heard about Gibbons was not true. one guy started. Look, there's been eight offensive line starters, so no, there's never been two together.
There's never been two.
The first one was Rosenthal in 95, and there's been seven since, unless I messed up my count. Brad Williams did an emergency. I remember that, but he was a defensive lineman. Ryan Harris was great. Sam Young was good. Trevor Robinson became good, so these guys right here started, maybe not Harris, but they started because Notre Dame had the offensive linemen. Like 03, 06, 08, you remember what Notre Dame's running games were like, at least in 06 and 08? Harris, I shouldn't say that about. He had Julius Jones. They had a good running game. And then Elmer and Hainsey, right? I didn't miss anyone, did I?
No, I mean, you had Trevor Robinson. Yeah. It's I got a question on this in my mailbag. Obviously I mentioned the Notre Dame guys, because the question was more like, can you think of other programs who have like kind of New Year's Six playoff aspirations who started one true freshman? Mitch Hyatt at Clemson in 2015.
That's what I was coming up with,
Andrew Thomas at Georgia in 2017. Both those teams played for the national title. Michael Jordan at Ohio State in 2016. They went 11-2, made the playoff.
Also North Carolina, 1982.
Yeah, he was also good. Alabama had Jonah Williams in 2016, Evan Neal in 2019. And if you want to go all the way back to Andre Smith, and then there are a couple of Iowa examples, Tristan Wirfs, Brian Bulaga, Penei Sewell at Oregon. So I guess like the takeaway is there's like, one, it can be done. And two, if you do it, you're definitely playing in the NFL, which is a good thing for your college program as you develop.
I wouldn't necessarily say it's a bad thing if one or both.
Both. I just meant both, not one. I think it's fine. One will start. I predict one will start. I think it's if both start, that's not great.
Yeah. Well, I mean, does it? So if Tosh Baker starts, a redshirt freshman,
I think that's different. I do think it's different.
Not a whole lot, though.
Yeah, he's had Bayless for an extra year.
It's bad for the reasons O'Malley pointed out. It's bad because it means Quinn Carroll didn't recover, or they had some misses. Yeah.
But I think that's
why it's bad.
No, I agree with that. But I do think that the coaching staff, you know, and Brian Kelly said, you know, they kind of play this little game. Okay, if Patterson's a tackle, this, if Patterson's a guard, this. But I think that this line of thinking that I'm about to say has to come into play. Should we play Spindler at left guard, or should we play Gibbons, knowing that Gibbons is strong, you know, stronger probably. Yeah. But really, is there that much of a difference right now? Because if there isn't, then you might as well go ahead and play the younger guy, because his ceiling's way higher and he'll get experience in the process.
I think it's just the nature of the position. Cause like nobody, we would never have a conversation. Is it a bad thing that Michael Mayer started over Brock Wright? Like, no, nobody ever had that conversation. I just think it's unique to the offensive line, because you cannot skip the strength building phase.
And I would still, as of right now, as I continue to play the game that I'm playing about configurations along the offensive line, I still think Gibbons is a starter over Spindler. But I do too,
and I want to add a reason why for that. So you start Blake Fisher at tackle, and you start Zeke Correll at center in his third career start, and you have Dylan Gibbons, or a fifth-year senior Dylan Gibbons with 4 years of Bayless and 5 years of offensive line work in between them, or you have Rocco Spindler. I have a feeling you're going to go with the guy, as long as it's close, to start out, the guy that can help other guys learn when they're down in Tallahassee and the stuff hits the fan. And all of a sudden, Tallahassee's players, they kind of are. All of a sudden, the Seminoles seem as fast as they were coming out of high school for once to the front seven, and it gets a little hairy down there. I think you just want someone to know what's going on pre-snap.
And none of this conversation changes my mind about how I think the Notre Dame offensive line will play this fall. Does it for you, Tim?
No, just maybe the first game. The first game.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying about going to Florida State, but this is still, I mean, even if Gibbons is on the field, the guy that's been around for 5 years, there is the chemistry of this offensive line still going to take time to develop.
Scott 24-105. What's the chance of Riley Mills overtaking Jason Adamiola as starter by season's end?
I don't expect that. I mean, I don't expect that. Jason Adamiola is a guy that brings a little bit more quickness. As sometimes you've seen in the videos where I've seen him actually coming off the edge, he may have twisted with a defensive end. I think Jason Adamiola remains the starter, but Riley Mills is, I mean, that's a tag team. We know that's going to be a tag team. I think that's going to be a really, really good position for Notre Dame this fall.
I mean, Jason Adamiola, I think he'd be high on my list of most impressive players from the spring practice videos. Top five easy. As these videos get more and more, you're sort of seeing some sub packages here and there, and you're seeing that the nickel dime line of Foskey and Bateloda and MTA and Adamiola in the middle. Like, I absolutely love that setup. So it's, I mean, Riley Mills is plenty of time to get 25, 30 snaps a game.
Right.
I think that would be a great role, and he's going to be a badass number two.
Yeah, I think the question is Jason Adamiola 2021 or Riley Mills 2022, not 2021 apiece. Like, Mills needs more time to be – Jason Adamiola is a pick for a breakout year for me.
Yes.
I agree.
I have wanted Jason Adamiola to be in that nickel and dime package for 3 years when he wasn't in it. And now I get my voice is being heard finally, guys. There is no it's because everybody's playing fast and loose. Like, Marcus Freeman and I prefer it that way. So there's
That's a hell of a combo of defensive tackle, isn't it?
Yeah.
JJ Allwine, more combined starts by the end of the 2021 season. Gibson and Dirksen or Fisher and Spindler?
Got to go Fisher and Spindler, right?
Yeah, because I don't think Dirksen will start a game.
Yeah, but I mean, Gibbons could be a 13-game starter.
Yeah, but is Spindler your first guard off the bench type thing? You know what I mean? Is that possible over Quinn Carroll?
Yeah, it's one of those good questions. Yeah, it's a good question. I'm not sure. I don't think Dirksen is ultimately going to figure in, even though I was, bent on. I really, how many times have I said I really liked the way he played coming out of high school, but it just hasn't. It hasn't come together for him. So I don't know, man. I think Gibbons is the guy that I would continue to pencil in there, but it's a good question from JJ Allwine. Denver Maximus, from everything we see in here, it sounds like Drew Pine is having a stellar spring. Odds still favor Jack Cohn starting, but when was the last time you felt confident in the top two quarterbacks on the roster? I know we still have yet to see Pine in real playing situations, but I'm basing it on what we've seen and heard.
Well, the last time I felt confident was 2018 when they had Wimbush and Book. And those guys were better than Pine and Cone. So I was pretty confident then. And I was confident in barely seeing Malik Zaire and Everett Golson too. I am not confident in the starting quarterback yet at Notre Dame. I just think their backup will be good too. I'm more confident in the backup than I was in January. Does that make sense? I think the backup
but
will
not,
be fine.
But not. Not compared to the Wimbush Book.
No,
I mean,
no,
I totally agree with you there.
I mean, I would throw Kaiser Zaire in there. I realize that season went totally sideways, but like, you felt really good about both those guys.
Oh yeah, you're right. I'm sorry. 16, time. Totally right.
Yeah, but I think Pine has gone from like, okay, what do we got? I always thought a good spring for him would be the same spring that Ian Book had in 2017. Where he had just redshirted, had a really good spring game, and you're like, huh, all right. I mean, I like this guy more than I thought I would. And I think Pine's having one of those springs where you're just like, all right, maybe they have something here that, let's dig a little bit deeper on.
Yeah, I think it's really difficult in spring practice with red jerseys on to say that you feel comfortable about Drew Pine.
Highlights they show us.
Against, life bullets in the fall because he can't be hit now. So yeah, he's going to be able to stand back there, and they're going to show us clips of him throwing completed passes. you know, but yeah, you know, I think we love his makeup. We love his savvy. You know, he's going to be a fun interview if and when we get those opportunities moving forward. And you feel good about what he's done this spring, but I don't know that I would go much further beyond that right now.
Do you guys remember coming out of spring 2017, as Pete mentioned, with Book and saying, huh, I bet you that guy becomes the winningest quarterback in the history of Notre Dame football right there. That seems like he's going to be well on his
way. No, but it was definitely like, yeah, he could. There could be something here.
Yes, for sure. Nick 2014, how much positional flexibility is there within the wide receiver group? For example, if Lindsey were hurt, could Keys or Davis slide over to X?
Well, Keys has played X, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, this is a situation where you would like to think that Jordan Johnson and Xavier Watts are, you know, in a position and capable of getting on the field and being productive. There's certainly flexibility with Wilkins because he's played the X and W. Lindsey is pretty much an X. Keys has played X, but I don't think that's a good position for him. Davis, certainly Avery Davis would be able to slide to the X, don't you think?
Yeah.
Yes. I wondered if that was going to be something they tried. If they decide, all right, like Takis has an awesome camp. And two tight ends is more than just a change up. It's like, oh, we're similarly productive in two tight ends this year as last year. Slot receiver is suddenly your best receiver, which is not, I don't know the last time slot receiver was the best receiver. Has it ever been the case under Brian Kelly?
No, and I mean, really,
that's in Cincinnati.
Should it be?
That's right.
Yeah, Marty Gilliard. But it is, right? Yeah. Like, I mean, Avery Davis clearly is the most trusted receiver right now. So can you move him to the X to keep him on the field more?
So I want to just point out that Pete Sampson stole a Monday Music for today. And that the predicted starting lineup is against Florida State is the two tight ends with Avery Davis sliding onto X for me. Because I don't think he's going to trust anybody more than that.
Well, and Tech is.
You were so smart.
I know. Thank you.
Takis has been prominent in the videos that we've seen. I want to ask Brian Kelly. You know, it's tough, these Zoom interviews, man. I mean, you want to ask. Pete, you come from more of a big picture perspective and as a daily website like we are, you need comments on specific players. So I find myself gravitating toward those. And I want to ask about Takis, but, you know, then you can't get back in line with your Zoom question. But Takis has been prominent. I'm going to ask because it looks like he's doing a pretty good job.
You should, because he might talked about how much they like the 12 package, and then you have your answer right there.
Right. Right, exactly. Question from TJ from PA70. The Notre Dame pass rush has evolved to be a strength of the Notre Dame defense over the last few seasons. Compare the potential for this year's group of ends and interior linemen to get pressure on the quarterback versus the last couple of years. Could this group eclipse last year's sack and pressure totals?
I think the D-line, if you separated the D-line out, from like Owusu-Koramoah, and yes, I think that it could. But I do not think the pass rush will be close to what it was in 2018. Or, 2019 it also was quite good.
Yeah, nowhere near 2018, I would say. They had three of the 10 best pass rushers in the country before guys started to get hurt, actually. That was a showcase of pass rushing that people have forgotten, I think. I don't know why people think Foskey's going to be better than Julian Okwara bending the corner, because he was unreal. I mean, last year's defensive line did a good job. They ended up with 12 games, 31 sacks. If they played 13 games, they probably could have gotten to that. You know, and look, they also had to play Alabama as the 12th game, right? If that 12th game was against someone else, they probably break the Brian Kelly sack record of 34. If you play not the best offensive line in the country for your last game and add another game. I think it'll be just as good as last year's. They have too many good players not to, right?
I think it'd be better than last year's.
Yeah.
I think if you like look at defensive ends individually, I don't think that they match up, at least not on paper right now, but that's not what it's going to be about Marcus Freeman scheming pass rush, but moving guys around, bringing guys from the second and third level at a pace that Clark Lee just didn't do. And it's funny. I mean, we talk about Clark Lee's defense almost now, like it wasn't very good. I mean, it was his approach was effective. It was very good.
Yes,
so, you know, I mean, I think that they can have more pass rush if we're comparing defensive ends. I don't think it's as good, but that's not what it's all about. It's 11 on 11, and I think they have a chance with a more aggressive scheme. I'm hearing you, Lou. I hear you.
he felt someone knocking, huh? He's like, what are you listening to? This is rhetoric. So just to put it in perspective, and Pro Football Focus goes way over the top on their pressures. They like add up every time somebody looks at a quarterback, but they do it consistently. Last year, the two leaders, they're both gone, were defensive ends, which makes sense, but 37 and 33 total pressures. MTA was next from the middle with 19. If you go back a year, Khalid Kareem, 44, and Aquara in 8 games, 32. Jameer Jones, 30 in about whatever amounts, wow, probably like 6 games. In 2018, the fourth place guy was Dalen Hayes with 28. The third place was Khalid Kareem with 37. I'm sorry. The fourth was Hayes. Third was Kareem with 37. Second was Tillery with 49. And Julian Aquara was credited with 61 quarterback pressures in 2018. So let's not say it's the best pass rush in a long time, but it'd be great if it's as good as last year's. Jim, 61!
61. Holy cow. But, you know, but is he remembered for that, or is he remembered for starting slowly?
He is remembered for starting slowly, next... but I choose not to do that.
Yeah. You got it?
Jim underscore Booney CRS. Does Zeke Carell have a snapping the ball too low problem? And it was grammatically correct how he wrote it. I'm very impressed by Jim underscore Booney.
Yeah. Carell appeared to have a problem on Saturday. Now, I think in previous instances, it's generally been Carmody, which makes sense because he's a tackle that was snapping the football. I don't know. Maybe I missed some bad snaps from Carell earlier in the spring. But, I mean, did he have any problems against North Carolina and Alabama snapping a football?
Yeah. Well, Carolina, he had two. Remember? Book turned one to a touchdown.
Yeah.
Oh,
it bounced,
right,
off his, yeah, it bounced, okay, off his leg. And there was another, right, one, well, I think Book saved also.
Yeah, he's got a bit of a problem.
Yeah.
So, hey, look, keep working on that.
I'm trying to coach 11 first graders to snap the football. It's not that easy. So, yeah.
Just all 11.
Maybe calm down here, Jim underscore Booney. It's hard work.
I think Zeke Carell has plenty of opportunities between now and Florida State to fine tune that. But yeah, you're right. North Carolina, there was a couple times, mm-hmm, and it has popped up. But that, I think that's one of the least of Notre Dame's.
Yeah, I don't have it high on my list. It was such a long practice video of low snaps is probably all we remember right now. And then the next one won't have that, I would guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was surprised they had that many in there, frankly.
There must have been 100 because they put
it. It's like, 20s. I thought these were supposed to be highlights.
Yeah.
Maybe they're highlighting the quarterback's hands. It was a nice catch.
All right, we've got a NFL draft coming up next weekend, and I am trying to get out of the story this week on the NFL draft. And so we have a question from ND Yinzer. Over under 5.5 number of Notre Dame players drafted in the first 144 picks, which is the first 4 rounds. Over under 5.5.
Under.
Under.
Yeah, I will bet anybody that wants to take the over, frankly. I've got under.
I mean, would you get action on 4.5?
4.5 makes it, yeah, because I think that, yeah, I think Ogundeji's kind of a swing guy. Maybe not. Your guy from The Athletic, Pete, had him lower than that. I do not believe, and this is not personal. I think it's not personal. I just don't think that. I don't think Dalen Hayes is a fourth round draft pick. I just don't, especially with his medicals, with the shoulder, right, issues that he has dating back to high school. I just don't see anybody taking a chance on him that soon.
I don't either. Have you seen a lot of him in the fourth round?
I think your guy had him fourth or fifth. Yeah. I just don't. Dalen Hayes is that type of player, but I've been wrong before and will be wrong again. But I don't think I'm going to be wrong on that.
He had Ogundeji at 142, and then he had Hayes in round 5. But I agree with your sentiment. Like, that seems high to me.
For some reason, five sounds more so much more plausible than four. Four just seems like you're, I mean, they're drafting you just to really be a contributor right away.
These days. I mean, I'm hoping for the best for him, but I just don't think that there is enough. I mean, take in consideration how many snaps he had at Notre Dame, the percentage of quality snaps. I just don't think that he's had enough.
I bet if I were to guess around for Hayes, I would probably guess late fifth round. Actually, I don't think I would drop it to sixth, but I wouldn't guess four for Ogundeji. I would guess five for Ogundeji, and you could be getting a bargain in either one of them. I'm not saying that's where they belong, but that's why way under 5.5, I would say four in the first.
Yeah, and of course, Owusu Koromoa, Liam Eichenberg, Tommy Tremble, Aaron Banks are all supposed to. Those are your four gimmies, right?
You're right. Right.
And then Ogundeji, I think it's kind of mixed on him. You know, I don't know that he's had. I don't know that he had enough productivity to warrant.
Good play. I mean, he's a promising player when you.
He's a good player.
All the things and he can grow into. So
yeah, and his measurables are really, really good, and that can be enough to tip the scales for one team out there.
ND13. What do you feel is the reason that Kyren Williams can break through as a redshirt freshman? Chris Tyree can be a serious contributor as a true freshman at running back, but the wide receivers don't take a big leap until their third or fourth season. Are the differences in learning and developing that significant, or is it a testament to those running backs?
You know, I mean, when I read the first part of the question, I wrote down different positions, different people, different responsibilities, different depth chart. There's no correlation between what we're talking about there, but he then says is learning and developing at the positions. And maybe I'm so conditioned to think about receivers taking time to develop at Notre Dame, but the positions are, the learning curve is completely different. A running back has to read a hole. A receiver has to read moving parts in a coverage that they don't even understand yet.
I wouldn't even go that far. I think that you answered the question with your first. It's everything. There's too many differences. I mean, it wasn't that long ago when these questions would have been like, why isn't Torian Folsom and Greg Bryant playing? Why is Cam McDaniel playing? Is there something about running back that's too complicated? Like, and then we'd be talking about blitz pickup and how important it is. There's just different positions, different skill sets, different fits in the offense. There's too many differences to compare, I think.
Yeah, and honestly, super talented running backs play at Notre Dame too. Greg Bryant wasn't playing because he wasn't talented enough to play. He was not ready to be on the field for Notre Dame for Brian Kelly because of off the field situations. I think it was until Willingham, which is all these stats get worse because he had bad program. There was only one year where they didn't have a freshman contribute at running back. Went from like, so it started in 72, the freshman eligibility rate, 72 to 2002. There was only one year where they didn't have a freshman. And that's the year they had Bettis and Brooks and nobody was going to get the ball anyway. Cause they didn't have any freshmen. They had Bettis, Brooks, Becton. Well, why were you giving the ball to somebody else? It's like 30 years of a running back getting carries as a freshman. And then you don't get until the Willingham era when you just didn't have any freshmen that were good at running backs. So you can explain away some of these years when you have bad freshmen as your running backs. Chris Tyree is not a bad freshman running back.
Right, he's so not. Kyren Williams has shown what a special back he is.
And Folston did play. Like Greg Bryant didn't. Folston was there. Yeah. Folston did play. He was
Good players play unless there are some other factors involved, which can be academics, it could be playbook, it could be injuries, it could be attitude. Good players play. It could be strength too, right?
I mean, they are a 12 strength. Package running
exactly,
team still.
Exactly. Yeah. And I realize that we're in a pocket here where the young receivers aren't emerging, but I mean, Kevin Austin was playing as a freshman. And then he got into trouble and didn't make a trip or two. So anyway, we're going to finish off with we talked about all the great things about Lou Somogyi, and we have a question from Playoff Pundit. Can you share with us a little known anecdote or your favorite memory of Lou? And Lou would not want this to be a maudlin memory of him. So we'll talk a little bit here real quickly about the quirkier side of one Mr. Lou Somogyi.
You guys worked with him a lot longer, so I'll do mine quickly. There's two things. The first thing Lou Somogyi ever said to me when I came in to interview, after I talked to Dan Silver, remember Dan Silver and John Hainsworth, they said, all right, well, now you got to go talk to Lou. I was like, all right, I'm looking forward to it. I went to go talk to Lou, and within 30 seconds, he mentioned the name Creighton Miller to me. And I just remember thinking to myself, this has nothing to do with this interview. But he's
why would he mention Creighton Miller?
I don't even remember why, but I remember thinking, he just brought up Creighton Miller. So that was in our first ever interaction. And the other one, we were sitting around the Goog. This was, I think it was during the Weiss days, because Weiss was always kind of late. The practices ran late. It was always the later at night, too. You know how Kelly gets done at 6, yeah. Weiss would be getting done at like 7:15.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And we're all sitting. That sounds like I'm complaining, 7:15. But when you've been there since 6, it's a long time. Yeah. And somebody was talking about someone's brother was going to be better than him. And it was one of those ridiculous ones where, like, if Michael Jordan has a brother, you say, oh, he's going to be better than his brother. You know, you hear those things all the time, like, this guy's going to be better than his brother. And Lou used a reference of Joey Browner coming in, going to be better than Ross Browner, who, if people know Lou, is probably his favorite player of all time, was Ross Browner. And Lou, the ultimate gentleman, goes, it's like when people tried to tell me Joey Browner is going to be better than Ross Browner. My ass, he's going to be better than Ross Browner. And it was the one thing to get Lou to cuss, was if you disparage Ross Browner's greatness.
Oh, man, there are a lot. I am really going to miss his 3-minute questions during press conferences where Brian Kelly, you can see me like, yeah, Lou, I know what you're going to ask. Just say it. Sometimes that would involve asking about a third team linebacker during USC week, which was a fun text exchange to have with Michael Birch when he was still on the job. But I think that this story is actually about Lou's dad, but I think it sums up Lou. I remember back when I was at Blue and Golden, like, you know, it was like 2004 or something, you know, we all had cell phones at that point. And Lou was telling about how he was at Meijer with his dad, and they're walking down an aisle and they had the mini cassette recorders that we all used before we had iPhones to record everything. And, Lou was recounting this, and his dad was like, what is that, Lou? And he's like, well, it's, you know, these mini cassette recorders, we use them for interviews. And his dad was like, man, what will they think of next? And I feel like that sort of summed up who Lou was. You're just like, what will they think of next? And I'm like, Lou, that was like 3 inventions ago that he thought of that. So like, yeah, the technology, and Tim, you did this way more than me, but like, there was a season where I was the guy that had to go down to the fax machine at the hotel lobby to read the pages of Blue and Gold and correct them and then try to fax them back. And man, that was some interesting tech frustration stuff. But man, Lou was just one of a kind that way.
I will miss being in the press box when either team, home or away, goes for a 2-point conversion too early in the game. Yes. And Lou could be 20 seats down from me, and we would both at the same time just lean back and make eye contact with each other. And that, and punters, because I've always through the years had difficulty with punters and their shanks. But a couple stories about Lou. People don't know this. When it was just him and me before UP, you know, technologically it was a lot harder to put this stuff together. So we would, we'd work all night. I mean, I can remember sleeping in the office for 2 hours and waking up in the morning and finishing the job. Lou would go to the local Hungarian Catholic Church, Our Lady, and play the organ for 7 a.m. Mass, regardless how long regardless if he stayed up all night. Lou, an accomplished organist, would go play for the Hungarian people at Sunday Mass. And here's the other one. When Lou said he wasn't worthy, he truly meant it. And the best example of that is that we had just finished a big project. I think it was what we used to call the yearbook. And again, technologically, it was just harder to do back then. So as a reward to himself, he went out and bought himself a new car. But then he felt so guilty about doing that, the car sat in his garage for like 6 weeks before he finally drove it.
A Honda Accord, I remember that.
That's
pretty good.
That's Lou Somogyi, who has no more deadlines, no more late nights.
And make sure anyone that listens to this, we have to do the Lou Somogyi and Al Lessar from the South Bend Tribune. When the Blue Gold game hits that point of the fourth quarter and the third stringer tackles the walk-on, you take your pen, and drop it because you're done taking notes. This doesn't matter anymore.
Look forward to doing that on May 1 with you guys.
He was one of a kind. We'll take it from here, Lou. God bless you.
Thank you for listening to the Irish Illustrated Insider Podcast. If you enjoy our coverage of Notre Dame football, please consider supporting the podcast with a small donation. Go to irishillustrated.com/support. Your support will help Irish Illustrated continue to be the leader in coverage of Notre Dame athletics.